All right, welcome to this week's edition of the Ellison Report, your friendly neighborhood magazine of politics, policy, and the people. Presented weekly on your radio dial and podcast link. And we're here at the home of Cool Jazz and More, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm your host and executive producer, Charles D. Ellison, at the WEAA studios here at the storied campus of Morgan State University, Baltimore, Maryland, here in the National Capital Region. Find us at Ellison Report on Twitter. Yet another active and disruptive week in Washington as the Trump administration entered week two of its existence. A lot on the plate. We had key cabinet confirmations. One of them, one big one that's still in a pattern of holdup. We now have a SCOTUS nomination or a Supreme Court nomination to fill that seat left vacant by the untimely death of Antonin Scalia. And we also have Democrats as well as progressives who are all still trying to figure it out. And so here to discuss the strategy and plays behind all of that is strategist Alan Kelly. He is CEO of Playmaker Systems, more at playmakersystems.com. He's also author of this landmark book you have to read. It's called The Elements of Influence, The New Essential System for Managing Competition, Reputation, Brand, and Buzz. For all you public relations, marketing, and communications students, that is a must read. You have to have it in your library. I've read it, enjoyed the book, and I've got Alan on the phone. Alan, how are you doing?
Hey, how are you, Charles?
All right, great to have you on, man. It's good to have you back.
Thanks.
So first 2 weeks of the Trump administration, and what do you make of the president's governing style? What are the most prominent plays to you?
Well, prior to his being nominated, it was sort of, he had two modes. He would I don't know, communicate by tweet or communicate by teleprompter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, clearly now he's very comfortable behind in the Oval Office, behind his desk, and he's very comfortable tweeting. He's not letting up. This is somebody, regardless of your politics, who is very kinetic, is very prone to make decisions and take actions, and is just phenomenally facile with his Twitter handle. I've just never seen anything like it. I'm sure we can all agree on that.
Mm. You said something there. You've never seen anything like that, and I'm real curious. Is there anything that's new to you that's sort of outside of the boundaries of your playbook or your play system that you've put together? Anything that's kind of new where you've had to sort of either redefine an existing play,
yeah,
or you've had to come up with a totally new play, a new definition?
Yeah. Well, there is a play, actually, that we, and, you know, maybe for the listeners' information, if they go to playmakersystems.com, there's a free resource there called the Standard Table of Influence. You can access it and use it interactively to figure out,
mm-hmm,
essentially the plays that people or organizations are running on you, by you, with you, for you. And there is a play we have in there that is actually called The Trump. and we're really chagrined by this because, oh, shoot, you know, we named it that play before Donald really rose to prominence. And we may have to change it because it just takes too long to explain all that. But the point of that particular play, or to be more accurate, influence strategy, is that it's like the game of bridge, where you put down a trump card, and that fundamentally sort of puts you back in charge of the flow of what's going on. And that is actually, and ironically, a signature strategy by Trump and particularly Kellyanne Conway, his top aide.
Mm-hmm. So there's a big use of distraction techniques or deployment of,
yep,
you know, what some of us like to call weapons of mass distraction. So, you know, he's doing one outrageous thing via Twitter, or he's got, you know, one of his advisors like Kellyanne Conway, who's,
yeah,
spouting off like,
yeah,
fake news,
yeah,
you know, about the Bowling Green massacre, or you have, you know,
right,
something completely off base said by his White House press secretary. So, you know, there's a lot of distraction, or, you know, as your, you know, as your standard table of influence calls it, diversion, a lot of deflect,
right,
and red herring.
Right.
So talk a little bit about that, about how effective that's been deployed so far.
Well, I'll give you a couple examples. Let's take Meet the Press from, I think it would be last Sunday, where Chuck Todd had Kellyanne Conway on. And it's really worth watching. But I just pulled two snippets from it. He says, basically, hey, it's a small thing, but the first time the White House Press Secretary, Sean Spicer, confronts the public, it's a falsehood, he says. Well, the play that he's running on her is a bait. And reporters and real pure journalists aren't supposed to run baits or lay out baits. They're supposed to just simply ask questions. But his is clearly and designed, as the definition goes, to taunt and to trap, to provoke her.
Mm-hmm.
Well, she immediately, she doesn't even wink a bat an eye. She says, Chuck, if we're going to keep referring to our press secretary in those types of terms, we're going to have to rethink our relationship here. Mm. remarkably smooth, and that's a play we call it a deflect, to dodge a point, the evasion of another player's query or attack.
Mm-hmm.
And she did that reflexively.
Mm.
I'll give you a better example that it made the news a little bit more. He said when she then uttered the fatal phrase, alternative facts, he says, alternative facts, what? You're kidding? The facts are not facts. Alternative facts are falsehoods. And the play that he ran on her was a call out to chide and deride. Well, Kellyanne tossed back her hair and said, Chuck, do you think it's a fact that or not that millions of people have lost their plans or health care insurance, da-da-da-da-da? And that was also a diverting play, but a little bit different from a deflect insofar mm-hmm. as we call it a red herring, where you sort of toss out an erroneous reference that's designed to force a conversation or a dialogue to go somewhere else where you'd like it to go. They absolutely, and Kellyanne Conway particularly, operates in the diverting mode because she has a hard time, I think clearly has a hard time defending, the relevant, the really biting, and the tough questions.
You know, there's a lot of provocation here as well.
Yes.
Where you have, you know, like the example that you gave where Kellyanne Conway is provoking Chuck Todd on Meet the Press, but you also have a lot of Sean Spicer, the White House press secretary, provoking media outlets that are there at those daily White House press briefings, or just President Trump and congressional Republicans provoking Democrats and progressives. I mean, how do Democrats and progressives, how do they counter that? What plays do they have in their arsenal to address that or to react or respond to it effectively?
Such a great question. It's something we've studied a lot. Every organization or person or constituency usually develops, and it can be isolated on our system, what we call a strategy signature. You know, it's as though a thumbprint is laid down. You go, oh, I know whose thumbprint that is. And what we have tended to see over time is that Democratic or progressive interests tend to be lower engagement, if you will. And if you look at our table, it means that they tend to err to the side of testing and diverting and framing, maybe freezing. They're generally a little bit more tepid, more cautious. And Republican interests, conservative interests, tend to run pressing plays, preempting plays, provoking plays. They tend to have more intrepid, I guess, and they tend to have better command and control. So they're basically, Republicans, I would say, are more aggressive, and I would say Democrats are not so much. And that kind of fits with the general thinking.
You know, taking a look at some of these recent executive orders by President Trump, and he did say during the campaign that he'd be very aggressive in his use of executive orders. We saw quite a few in the first couple of weeks. And in fact, you had actually more than the Obama White House in the first week in terms of executive orders and presidential memoranda issued by President Trump. And then there was this outrage over the so-called Muslim travel ban.
Don't call it a ban, Charles.
Don't call it a ban. Don't call it a ban. But I want to talk about that. I want to talk about how that, because there were multiple plays that were happening. And I'm glad at the top of the show you did reference, because I forgot to do that, the Playmaker Influence Decision System, which I'm a big fan of, and folks should check out at playmakersystems.com if they want to kind of understand what's going on here. But I noticed there was sort of a slowdown in the pace of executive orders, because we heard rumors of a wave of executive orders that were supposed to come through in the second week, and it did kind of slow down. Did he have to recalibrate a bit after the fury over the travel ban?
Yeah, it sure seems like it. I mean, it's an awfully low sample, but it sure seems like it. And we know how sensitive he is and how much he's watching the boob tube. So there was a couple things he did I thought that were quite uncharacteristic this week through Twitter, and that is that to the ban, he actually ran a play called a recast. Hmm. It's sort of a concessionary play. Say, okay, look, you kind of got me. But you know what? Maybe it's a ban, maybe I said that, but you know, the real point is we have to keep America safe, blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. We tried to, and it's one of a few pivoting plays in the system. And that showed some contrition by the uncontrite, you know, Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one he did was that, so far as I know, he has not responded or countered Barack Obama's statement, basically nudging people to go out and protest.
Mm-hmm.
He hasn't touched that. That's so unlike him. So the play he ran there, Carino, is called a pass. He does nothing. It's like the no play.
Hmm.
And that tells me that he is not going to be entirely stubborn, you know, to the ways and the flows of the market or what people are saying.
Was that so much a pass or was it a pause? You know, because he didn't expect that. He didn't expect the outcry, and he didn't expect also a formal statement from his predecessor, from the previous guy who suddenly is jumping into the fray.
Well, you know, it's sort of a judgment call. If he comes back in a couple of days and blasts Obama, then you'll know you're right, it was a pause. But it seems to me that enough news cycles have happened, we're on to other things.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, Obama came in and kind of took a shot and got away with it. And I think the Trump's calculus was that he couldn't fight that. And it's really interesting to watch him tiptoe around Obama. That seems to be, Obama's bigger than Australia.
You're
Obama's bigger than Mexico.
Right. Which we're running on time. We only have about a few more minutes left, and we're going to bring you back a little bit more often, Alan, to talk about this. But about the confirmation process that's been taking place with the cabinet picks,
mm-hmm.
And also the Supreme Court nominee Neil Gorsuch. I'm wondering, is there a sort of an emerging pattern of plays, or are there some plays that you found kind of strung together that were thematic throughout the confirmation picks and also the hearings? You know, he's only got one really major one. It's Betsy DeVos, education secretary nominee, that's being held up. But everything else seemed to, despite all of the outcry, all of the angst, you know, everything else seems to be, you know, sort of going according to schedule as planned.
Yeah, I think the Supreme Court nomination and the other cabinet nominations have been sort of at a dull roar. And perhaps the answer there, in other words, there's not much what I call play action.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe the answer lies in the fact that the Democrats just simply don't have any power. That's something that hews so closely to real law and real, you know, order and rules that there just is not a lot of wiggle room. And so it doesn't really pay for them to protest too much.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you're right. It's been kind of matter of fact and sort of uncharacteristically, I don't know, it's been non-Trumpish.
Right. I mean, you know, there have been some protests and, you know, Senate Democrats have, you know, tried to make a lot of noise. But at the end of the day, these nominations are pretty, I'm not going to say they're sailing through.
Yeah.
But they're reaching their ultimate goal. So,
well, you know, is Bannon a cabinet appointee? I don't believe so. And
no.
And so because he's not, because there's no official rules and orders, things like that, then he's red or meat to go after, and they have been.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, just look at the Time magazine cover calling him the great manipulator.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a call out actually, or a certain kind of a label play that Time magazine has run on that particular advisor. Crazy stuff.
All right. Alan Kelly, CEO of Playmaker Systems. You got to go to playmakersystems.com and check out his playmaker influence decision system, the standard table of influence, which he was describing earlier on in the segment. Alan, we'll have you back on. Thanks so much, man. It's been great talking to you as always.
Thank you, Charles.
All right. And when we come back, I believe up next is American University's Chris Edelson on whether we're seeing signs of executive overreach in the Trump administration. Here at your source for Cool Jazz and More, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And we're back at the Ellison Report, made possible by support from Island Press, more at islandpress.org, and from partners like BE Strategy, Strategy Research Communications, more at strategybe.com. Not even a full month into the new administration, and newly installed President Trump signed 6 executive orders in just 1 week, one order more than President Obama in his first week. As if it couldn't get worse, the top of week 2 invited one of the most unsettling executive actions we've seen in recent memory, ambitiously demanding the elimination of 2 regulations for every 1 Trump-era regulation created. This doesn't include an additional 10-count presidential memoranda thus far, which also count as executive actions. But is that really executive overreach, the same kind conservatives complained about during the Obama administration? Here to examine that question is Chris Edelson. He's a professor of government at American University, more at american.edu. Professor, how are you doing? Thanks for joining us.
I am having the most difficult period of my life. This is what we're facing right now. It's so different. You mentioned the comparison to Obama. We're dealing with real authoritarian threat to constitutional democracy, which we've never seen.
Wow. Wow. I mean, are we seeing the first signs of a Trump administration that will govern by executive order or fiat? Would you characterize this as executive overreach?
Oh, sure. I mean, it was clear during the campaign. This is a man who does not believe the rules apply to him. He does not believe the law applies to him. And he's basically what he's saying right now is he's saying, I'm going to do things. I'm going to do what I want. And I dare anyone to stop me. And so far, for the most part, and this is what troubles me most of all, the answer has been no one really is stopping him, for the most part. I don't mean to exaggerate. And there are some things that encourage me, notably public response, but this is a very, very dangerous situation, and it can get much worse very quickly.
Let me ask you, as far as the danger, the sense of urgency, are you worried about what sorts of dangers are you worried about? Are you worried about a constitutional crisis?
I think we have one already.
Okay.
Yeah, I think we have a constitutional crisis already. And what I mean by that is two things. One, we have a president who has disregarded the Constitution and disregarded the rule of law through his business conflicts, corruption. He's making money off the office of the president. It's a violation of Article 1 of the Constitution. Congress has done nothing. He has claimed authority to torture if he chooses to do so. What happened over last weekend is just monstrous. There are reports of a 5-year-old child separated from his mother, handcuffed, a 5-year-old child. Sean Spicer defended this. What else, Press Secretary? He said, we can't rule people out as dangerous based on their age. But this is a president who's ruling as an authoritarian. It's a constitutional crisis because Congress hasn't acted. The second crisis is courts did step in last weekend, and they issued rulings saying, wait a second, what you're doing has to stop. You can't take people who are illegally in the United States and detain them and deport them. There were reports, and I have to be careful because this stuff is happening so quickly. It's hard to know for sure, but there were reports, including by one member of Congress, that the executive branch, people at the airports, were not obeying these court orders. If that's right, that's a serious, serious problem. That's a Nixonian problem that we only got, 5 years into Nixon, and it's happened in the first 2 weeks.
Hey, speaking about court orders, but, issuing a court order is one thing, but being able to enforce the court order is another. And so who can enforce it?
I mean, normally court orders are enforced because people obey them. It's very, very rare to have a president or an executive branch or executive people working for the executive branch not follow court orders. I mean, in theory, of course, it can happen. People can do anything. As I'm saying, the most recent example I can think of is Nixon, when a judge ordered him to turn over tapes and he said no. It just doesn't happen very often. When it does, it's a constitutional crisis because our system depends on the different branches respecting limits on their power when they're enforced by the other branches of the government. When they don't, we have a real crisis for constitutional democracy.
You know, let's talk a little bit about executive orders and executive actions, exactly what those are. What does that entail? What are different types of executive actions? And are executective orders the same as presidential memoranda? What form of executive actions have more influence than another?
And they shouldn't really be separated out. To me, it's all, so the executive order, you mentioned the number that Trump has issued as opposed to President Obama. Mm-hmm. It's not so much the number that's an issue. It's what they're doing. You can issue executive orders that are meaningless, that are formalities. The executive orders that Donald Trump is issuing are part of a broader pattern of authoritarianism. And what I mean by that is the president who says, I decide what I do. I don't care about legal limits, whether it's building a wall, whether it's keeping people out of the country based on their religion, whether it's denying people the right to come back to the country who are here illegally, whether it's deciding when to torture. So the executive orders, you're right, they're one form of presidential action, but they're not the only form. And the pattern I'm seeing here, and it's a pattern that was clear even before the election, is a president who believes that the rule of law, and ordinary rules simply don't apply to him. And that's the most troubling thing.
Mm-hmm. So, how does that look so far? I mean, was I accurate there? Was I on mark about, how many executive orders this president, I mean, I know it's only 2 weeks in, but how many executive orders he's issued compared to President Obama? I mean, is that a fair comparison to make? Is that something we should be doing? You know, exercise we should be engaging in over the next few months?
I don't think the numbers matter. Mm-hmm. I'll give you an example. President Roosevelt issued an executive order that led to the internment of Japanese Americans. That was one order. Mm-hmm. That was terrible. I mean, it doesn't matter. You know, one order can be terrible. And the orders that we're seeing so far are bad orders because they're orders that suggest the president doesn't recognize limits in his power. And all of the alarm bells should be going off. And it's not so much the number of them. The executive order on immigration, refugees alone, is a very dangerous order just by itself. But there is a larger pattern here, and that's troubling as well, as I said.
Beyond the Muslim travel ban that we've been talking about quite a bit lately over this past week, I mean, what are some other orders there that you've looked at closely that you find a bit more alarming that kind of, you know, sort of snuck under the popular discussion radar?
Well, the Keystone and Dakota pipeline orders are also troubling, though not as obvious. And I'm not sure yet. We'll have to see. For instance, the Dakota pipeline is apparently about 80% complete. Mm-hmm. And what had happened is President Obama stopped construction of the project because he said the Army Corps of Engineers needs to issue a report saying whether it's legal for it to go ahead. Mm-hmm. What Trump did is he issued an executive order that said, I want that report expedited. So the question is, what does that mean? For an ordinary president, I'd say no big deal. He's asking for a report, okay, whatever. For this president, because he's made clear, I do what I want, the rules don't apply to me, is he telling the Army Corps of Engineers, you better give me what you want to go ahead with this thing, and I don't care what the law says? I don't know, but I'll be watching that. What he did with the executive order on the wall, that hasn't gotten as much attention because it's rightly been overshadowed by what's happened with at the airports. But bless you. The wall, that's a dangerous thing because this is not really his decision to make. Congress has to, it's estimated it would cost $25 to $35 billion to complete a wall on the southern border of Mexico. He can't do that by himself, but he's cultivating this image of, I am president, I act, others are not really part of the decision-making process. That's not a good model for constitutional government.
Hey, I was reading a column from Washington Post cartoonist, actually, Tom Tolles, and it was titled, Might Be Time for That Constitutional Convention After All. You know, a lot of conservatives have been arguing for that, especially over the past few years as they've dominated an increasing number of state legislatures and you know, they have dominance obviously in Congress as well. I mean, do you think that that's an appropriate fix? I mean, is that a road we should go down, you know, that maybe Republicans and conservatives might start getting a bit concerned about this authoritarianism in the White House and might put together some sort of constitutional convention to resist that, to counter it?
Every avenue should be explored, and Republicans and conservatives are clearly deeply concerned about this. David Frum wrote a sobering piece for The Atlantic this week where he describes the Trump administration as an authoritarian administration. He closes by saying, I'm paraphrasing, he says, this is the greatest that our constitutional democracy has ever faced, and the question of what will happen is up to us. Mm-hmm. And he's right about that, and I would consider every possibility. Constitutional convention, I think about The primary things I think about, though, are, one, impeachment and removal from office. Two, I've argued that if we find out that, and this is, we don't know for sure, but if we found out the Trump administration colluded with the Russians and knew what was happening during the election, I've argued a constitutional amendment should be passed providing for a new election. There's also the 25th Amendment, and this is tricky because this can be dangerous, but the 25th Amendment provides that the vice president and a majority of the cabinet can send a message to Congress saying they believe that the president is simply incapable of carrying out his duties. Mm-hmm. We're seeing a president who's really unhinged and removed from reality and doing dangerous things, whether it's threatening to invade Mexico or alienating close allies like Australia. That procedure could be used. All of these are, you know, far-fetched and unusual procedures. I've never advocated for any other president. It's also important to note they would never work right now. You need a majority, supermajority of Republicans in some cases. But the reason I'm saying we need to look at this is people have said in another context, the Constitution is not a suicide pact. And that, you know, we have a dangerous, and I don't use this word lightly, a dangerous madman who's in the White House. And it's a real threat to not just our Constitution, but also security, doing things that are dangerous for the country. And I think we have to examine every possible legal, constitutional, and I should emphasize peaceful process that can be used to limit his power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right, we've been talking with Chris Edelson. He's a professor of governance at American University. Also, you just had a book that came out not too long ago, Chris, Power Without Constraint.
Yeah.
Check that out. Okay, so I have to check that out. I haven't read it yet, but I'm real curious about it, and I forgot to mention it at the top of the show.
Oh, I appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm gonna check that out. Yeah, I've heard about it. So, Power Without Constraint by Chris Edelson. You can also catch him on Twitter at Chris Edelson. Hey, man, thanks so much.
Of course.
We'll have you back on. Take care.
Thank you.
Okay, all right. Next, it's Cleveland State University's Daron Kallir on the recent nomination of Neil Gorsuch for Supreme Court. Here at your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community.
The boundaries, don't let nobody stop your flow. So speak, sing my song. Canabre,
Guatecuma,
Canabre,
Casacunia,
Canabre,
Emigitia, Yentumia, Yopena, Samapo.
And we're back at the Ellison Report, made possible by support from Oneness Mobility. More at OneNessMobility.com and from partners like BE Strategy, Strategy Research, Communications. More at StrategyBE.com. Also, don't forget about listeners like you who support efforts like this. Find out more about how you too can contribute at WEAA.org. Here's a hint. Just click on Donate. Daron Kallir is a clinical professor of law at Cleveland State University. He joins us to examine the nomination of Neil Gorsuch for the U.S. Supreme Court, what that means, and how easy or difficult that nomination will move through the Senate. Thank you for being here, Professor. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me today, Charles.
All right. Excellent. Excellent. So give us your initial take on the nomination of Neil Gorsuch. What do you suppose is the ideological or political reasoning behind this particular nomination? What specifically makes him appealing for the Trump administration and base conservatives? And by the Trump standard, was this a particularly smart pick?
Yes. Let me start with a big yes. I think from the Trump White House, that was one of the smartest decisions we've saw to date, actually. Mm. We're considering so many other decisions being made. And I really want to begin by emphasizing how important that issue is. I know that today's schedule was dominated by, you know, the DeVos pick and the conversation with the Prime Minister of Australia and the
right.
new warning to Israel and Iran. And the Gorsuch, perhaps, nomination was moved a little bit to the background. This nomination may shape the Supreme Court and the law of the land for the next 40 years. Hmm. I think that this is an extremely important issue, and we should not take it off the agenda just because we have a line of communication with the Prime Minister of Australia. This is very, very important. So I think it was a terrific pick by the Trump administration. But I think that the two main questions to ask here are, one, what do we know about Judge Gorsuch's legal views? And second, should the Democrats mount the filibuster? These are two separate questions. Mm. That means that even if his legal views are palatable, which they are, to the Republican base and to the White House, I think that the question is, should the Democrats mount a filibuster? And I think that the answer to both questions is, by the way, yes. I think that his legal views are very much in line with the White House and the Republican base. He's a he's a true dissenter of you know, of Justice Scalia. But there is a big but here. Should the Democrats just let this nomination through the Senate? And I think the answer must be no.
Did you take Gorsuch as more of a mainstream conservative than a firebrand conservative? And that's another reason too why his nomination didn't create such a, you know, such a ruckus, such a big public ruckus. I mean, you know, of course, folks are concerned. You had the usual set of activists and advocates, particularly on the left, who were very resistant to this nomination, at least, you know, going on record as saying they're resistant to it. But, you know, for the most part, as you said, it was a very quiet nomination. And so, you know, that was deliberate, I take it. He's not like a firebrand conservative like Antonin Scalia was.
I humbly disagree. I think that what's important to understand is that we moved to the right as a country. And what used to be mainstream just 10 years ago or 15 years ago is no longer that. The Supreme Court has recently ruled in a series of cases that moved us as a nation, or at least legally, much to the right, starting, of course, with the Citizens United, but also the gutting of the Voting Rights Act, which is the, you know, the hallmark, perhaps, of the entire civil rights movement, and more recently with the Holly Hobby case, deciding 5-4 that even if a non-for-profit or a corporation goes down to the market, they still have their own religious views that may prevent them to provide contraception to their female employees. Neil Gorsuch wrote this as an appellate judge. He wrote those views as an appellate judge. So to say that this is not a firebrand decision, these are decisions that were thought of just 5 or 10 years ago as completely revolutionary. The idea that a corporation has the right to free speech, as we saw in Citizens United, or the idea that they had a religious conscience and therefore they can refuse to provide contraception to their female employee, despite the fact, let us remember, that the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, was the law of the land. That is, in my mind, extremely, let's say, away from the mainstream, or at least as we understood that term to be just a few years ago. And this is what Gorsuch wrote and believes. The same is true for Roe v. Wade. The same is true for the right of privacy. The same is true for gay marriage. And let me remind you that bringing him to the Supreme Court may reverse all that in a 5-4 decision. More importantly, perhaps, we should recall that Justice Bork, or Judge Bork, I'm sorry, never became a justice. Judge Bork was rejected for these exact similar reasons, but that was, you know, 30 years ago, and now it looks almost tame in comparison.
And you know, I'm real curious, Duran, is this the new way of nominating and confirming Supreme Court picks? President Obama's SCOTUS, or Supreme Court of the United States nominee, just for the for the listeners out there who are wondering, what does SCOTUS mean? But President Obama's SCOTUS nominee Merrick Garland languished for quite a while and ended up with no hearing or any vote as Republicans waited for the election outcome. And it was peculiar how that episode didn't trigger the kind of constitutional crisis that we expected. It was peculiar how it was allowed to just happen. So with how this played out, did this set a new precedent in how judges are picked and confirmed?
Thank you so much for this question. I think it's an excellent question. And I think that there was a major disconnect between the liberal elite, if I may use that much maligned term, and the people, and especially the people of the United States. I participated in many a convention where people were literally celebrating the nomination of an excellent judge, or the elevation of the chief judge of the D.C. District Court to the United States Supreme Court. They never imagined that the nomination of this truly, truly phenomenal judge, who was confirmed unanimously to the Court of Appeals, will face any resistance, let alone a total blockage, as happened. Once that happened, it caught, I think, everyone by surprise, and And I think that people were so shocked, and I kept heard them saying, and here's the disconnect, the Republicans will pay a dear price in the polls for doing this. I think this is the disconnect. I think that Democrats must understand that when Republicans, or anyone for that reason, for that purpose, goes to the poll, they don't think whether or not Justice Scalia's seat is still vacant. Mm-hmm. Most people don't even know, or are not even aware of that fact, let alone it's not even their, one of their first 20 considerations is, did I have enough money in the bank? Do I owe money, a mortgage on my home? Can I afford letting my daughter get married? These are the questions that they are concerned about, their job, their family, and Justice Scalia's vacant seat is not even the top 10 reason. And so I thought that it was a brilliant, politically brilliant move by the Republican, but unfortunately a devastating blow to the Constitution. And let me say, let me give you just a very interesting, perhaps, and different perspective on this. Mm-hmm. The United States Supreme Court would not consider intervening in a question where the House Majority Leader says, I know that Section 2, Article 3 of the United States Constitution read that the president shall, and I emphasize the word shall nominate, and by with advice and consent of the Senate, shall appoint judges of the Supreme Court. It says so in the Constitution, shall. And the question should be asked, why did anybody go to the Supreme Court and say, hey, it's a constitutional duty, they must do it, they must provide advice and consent.
Right.
Doesn't say which advice and consent. It could be a negative, but they must provide that. And as we all remember, Mitch McConnell announced it on the very day that Justice Scalia passed, that he will not let a hearing go forward, basically abdicating his constitutional duty. So two things about this. There are Supreme Courts in other countries, for example, in Israel, where I'm from, mm-hmm. that you can go to the Supreme Court and ask them to issue a mandamus, which means a particular order to the government saying you must do that. By must doing that, let me just clarify that that means you have to provide advice and consent as the Constitution reads. It doesn't tell you what type of advice or consent, but you have to provide to do something. You have to do something to answer to your constitutional duty. The second issue here is that the Republicans kept celebrating Scalia's originalist and textualist approach, saying we have to take the Constitution as it's written. We have to read the words and follow the words. No new understandings, no new meanings, no developing Constitution,
right.
And no living tree and so forth. But the Constitution requires that. And had Justice Scalia woke up from his grave, he would say, you have to follow the letter and the word of the Constitution, which
right.
they didn't do as well. So I think on both those terms, the fact that they had a constitutional duty and they celebrated the textualism and the idea that the Constitution should be read as written, I can't see how they got away with it. But it was clear to me that the voter could care less about whether or not there is a vacant seat on the Supreme Court.
I think you're right. There was a heavy reliance. Well, first, there was a heavy expectation that Hillary Clinton was going to win that election. And two, there was a heavy reliance on a mythology of the voter somehow caring about, I'm very much with you on that, somehow caring about a Supreme Court nomination or being motivated once they get to the polls by the vacant Supreme Court seat. I got you for about a minute more. What are the issues, that sort of those big topic issues you think that are before the Supreme Court now or that are in the pipeline that Gorsuch's would have an enormous impact on? And are there issues where President Trump could regret having ever picked Gorsuch in the first place?
Well, the second question is more interesting. With regards to the first, there is a little bit of a disagreement, but there are several voices right now asking whether or not Gorsuch's nomination will get in before the last 2 weeks of April, where the blockbuster cases of the Supreme Court will be heard. Mm-hmm. In my mind, he won't. And I believe that, Richard Blumenthal and other people on the Senate who are very well-versed in the Supreme Court calendar will do everything in their power to make sure that this term, as the Supreme Court years are called, that this term, the Supreme Court will not hear cases with 5-4, but only 4-4. If that will be the case, that everything that right is now on the docket will not be heard by Gorsuch. But as I said earlier in the beginning, his influence is enormous. He's 49 years old, is the youngest justice since the nomination of Justice Thomas. And I can't even imagine. I mentioned earlier Roe v. Wade. I mentioned gay rights. I mentioned women reproductive rights. And I mean, there are so many things that with 5-4, he can reverse that it's really scary.
Wow.
The second question.
I'm actually going to have to cut you off there, too, Professor Khalir. We got to have you back because there's a bunch of other questions I have for you as well. So we're probably going to have you back in the next week or two to talk a bit more about that nomination. Daron Khalir is professor of law at Cleveland State University. He's been joining us by phone. Thanks again, Professor.
Thank you. My pleasure, sir.
All right. Take care. We'll talk to you soon. Up next, the Center for American Progress is Liz Kennedy on what the voter fraud fight means for the future of elections. Here at your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community.
Appreciate the season, but
all right, and we're back at the Ellison Report, made possible by support from partners like BE Strategy and from listeners like you. Go to WEAA.org for more information on how you, too, can contribute. Center for American Progress's Liz Kennedy is Director of Democracy and Government Reform at the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org, for more information. And she joins us by phone. She's back on the show. Great to have you back on, Liz.
Thanks, Charles. Great to be here.
All right. So there's a lot to cover. But I wanted to get your perspective first on what's unfolding as this new administration's heavy reliance on executive orders takes center stage. Is this an unusually high number of executive orders for a president to issue during his first weeks in office? And what about these orders and the way in which they're being issued? How does that concern you?
Well, it does seem, first of all, this is absolutely rapid fire and 180 degree turns on some critical American domestic and foreign policy questions. So it is really definitely outside the norm, the way he is making policy by fiat in these ways. I think particularly when you look at the fact that Congress is dominated in both houses by members of his own party.
Mm-hmm.
So whereas after many years of just complete, essentially total Republican obstruction to President Obama's policies that were supported by the mandate that he earned at the polls, he did issue incredibly important protective executive orders on things like LGBTQ equality, protecting American, children who had been brought here who then through the DACA program were able to, live life out of the shadows. So he advanced some policies in that way, but that's when the Republican Congress was obstructing him. Here, President Trump has a Republican majority in Congress and yet is still choosing to really move outside of any kind of accountability and checks and balances and taking these steps unilaterally. I think in terms of the rollout, we obviously saw the just terrible human consequences of the haphazard manner in which his, frankly, illegal Muslim ban was just dropped down, basically kind of an iron curtain, if you will, just dropped down at the airports when people were midair on Friday. And so, we'll see the courts pushing that back when he is stepping outside of his legal bounds.
Yeah, I have to ask you, Liz, because you also had some reports of enforcement officials or borders and customs officials defying those court orders. And I'm wondering, what's the enforcement mechanism there? If courts do rule in favor of the opposition, rule in favor of folks, like the American Civil Liberties Union, for example, and other lawyers who are defending migrants who are trying to get into the country. How are they going to enforce it? How are they going to get those folks at those border stations, at those airports, to say, you know what, okay, it's a court order, I've got to follow it?
Charles, you raise a critically important question.
I know it's tough.
I think many people are deeply concerned about the consequences of a Trump presidency, but perhaps did not realize how quickly we may be facing what you describe would be a complete constitutional crisis, essentially.
Yeah.
I think, I'm sure your audience is aware that our system of government is based on checks and balances between three co-equal branches of the federal government: the legislature, the presidency, and the courts. There were certain instances throughout our history that where there have been challenges of power. But we are a nation based on the rule of law. The courts say what the law is. And the courts that have ruled on this administration's inhumane Muslim ban have absolutely all come down to say, no, the plaintiffs have the likelihood of winning on the merits, and they have issued orders that the federal branch needs to comply with. This is a crucial basis of the stability and prosperity of our entire country, and in fact, our leadership in the world. So that is something that people will be looking at very, very closely. I know, I think people were just discussing recently, are the CPB officials complying with this? And if not, what are the next steps? And that is certainly something that if, in fact, the executive branch is going so far as to not comply with an order from a federal judge, the next step is that they are held in contempt. And the next step after that is total accountability, with phones ringing off the hook in Congress, asking them to finally exert some accountability and authority over what at that point would be a rogue president.
So, it's just real funny, Liz, too, the way you sort of started off with that answer, because there is like this big national moment of disbelief. It's like, it's like we're the character in the bad, kind of low budget sci-fi or horror flick, where, the protagonist is trying to tell folks, hey, they're these ghosts, or, hey, these aliens that just landed. And everybody's like, that doesn't exist. There's no such thing as ghosts or aliens. But and so in this particular instance, like we didn't really believe that something like this could happen. We just didn't dig deep enough into the imagination. And so it's kind of like that big public moment of disbelief. I did want to move on, Liz, to another subject about that I know you've been writing quite a bit about, and that's voter fraud. Recently, the president indicated concerns he had over voter fraud. And I wanted an opportunity to talk with you a little bit more deeply about that. The president has said that he's interested in launching a federal investigation into voter fraud. And do you see that plan accelerating as Senator Jeff Sessions, the senator from Alabama, enters the Justice Department as the attorney general? And how bad could it get the way you're looking at it right now?
Sure. So that's interesting, because to your earlier point, I have concerns about our kind of collective failure of imagination, failure to see past, we are basically a very prosperous, safe and secure country where jobs have been, going up since the Great Recession under progressive economic policies. Mm-hmm. And so people just think things are good. They can never be as horrible as they have been. Well, they could be. Mm-hmm. Policy has consequences. Elections have consequences. Who governs us has deep, deep consequences. And then here, instead of a failure of imagination, this is this question of, and frankly, just lies about people showing up with millions of illegally cast ballots. It is unfortunately completely made up, but also a precursor for voter suppression. And we have to start from the position that in America, committing to the fact that we are all equal citizens before the law, mm-hmm. and that every eligible American, has the right to have their voice heard by government. That is, you know, the basic premise of democracy, of a government by the people, is that all people should have their voices heard at the polls. That's how the people, who are the source of power in our democracy, are able to determine our futures collectively, making these choices at the polls. Mm-hmm. The fact that frankly, it's the Republican Party in state after state, in North Carolina, in Texas, in Wisconsin, they tried strict photo ID in Michigan, are basically weaponizing this question of voter access, much like we had done for centuries when people of color were, you know, enslaved and their citizenship not recognized at all. And then through a bloody war, we moved past that. And yet still, through decades of Jim Crow, people of color were kept from exercising their political power through facially neutral ways, right? It's just supposed to be a test about citizenship. And of course, women weren't, you know, quote unquote, given the right to vote. Women didn't successfully win, demand through their own demonstrations the right to vote until less than 100 years ago. So it's been a journey of getting to a place where we all recognize that we have equal rights to have our equal voices heard at the polls. Since in the last 10 years, and then specifically in the last, since 2010, when we saw a rash of strict photo ID bills coming through, and then since 2013, when the Supreme Court really removed the core protections of the Voting Rights Act, we have seen voter suppression spread throughout the country. We know that it is keeping eligible Americans from being able to vote at the polls, hundreds of thousands of Americans. It's very difficult to assess the actual numerical impact of people who don't even choose to go to the polls because they believe they don't have the right ID. And we also know that, as you say, Jeff Sessions has a history of improperly prosecuting Martin Luther King's associates for registering African Americans in Alabama. So a man who called the Voting Rights Act intrusive, when it is in fact the crown jewel of the last civil rights movement, is a very dangerous figure to be putting in charge of any actual investigation. I should also mention the Bush Department of Justice did do a years-long deep dive into this question as to whether any kind of illegality affects our elections, and they found essentially no real cases, even though they were looking so hard that their Department of Justice was embroiled in a massive scandal that caused the Attorney General to resign. I mean, how short our memories are here. So this
I forgot about that.
Really,
right.
Yeah, exactly. Well, if people would like to a little walk down memory lane on some of these questions, we do have a paper up on the American Progress website. Trump's threat to investigate American voters is a danger to democracy. We posted that last week, so that again is on the AmericanProgress.org website. And we hope that he's backed off. But the point is, they don't need to just to launch an investigation to do deep, hurt.
It's been done before. And Liz, we actually have to wrap up, too. And it's thanks for making that point. Go to AmericanProgress.org to check out that white paper. Liz Kennedy has been on with us. She's the director of Democracy and Government Reform at the Center for American Progress. Thanks again, Liz. We'll talk to you again.
My pleasure, Charles. Bye-bye.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye. Thanks. That's a wrap on this week's edition of the Ellison Report. I'm your host, Charles Ellison. Go to @EllisonReport on Twitter. Thanks to Andre Melton, Tyron Rice, digital producer Ali Post, and others at WEAA. Continue to listen in at the home of cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And we'll talk to you next week. Be safe in the meantime.
Sucker must get the ice, want them mounted on. Still them have them pay switch back, them belong. Enough for everyone. Jamaica enough for everyone. Jamaica enough for everyone. Jamaica enough for everyone.